Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on the treatment of liver cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you. We have on the call today over 412 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and parts of the United States, and we also have international participants from China, Canada, India, Korea, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's truly a global call. Today's program was supported by a grant from Abbott, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all those materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers will be following, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource to all of you, and those are all free resources for all of you. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. We very much rely upon your feedback as we plan future programs. You may have a topic that you'd like us to offer in the future, and we're planning lots of programs for this year, so we take very seriously your recommendations. So if you would take a moment and tell us what you'd like us to offer, we'll try very hard to do that. And indeed, the program today, the topic, the focus on liver cancer is one that many of you have been asking us to do, so we have the program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I'm going to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Huda Pat. Dr. Pat is Professor of Medicine, Chief of GI Oncology Research, University of New Mexico Cancer Center. Dr. Pat has spoken on these programs before on a number of occasions, and he is going to go over an overview of liver cancer, including current standard of care. He's going to also address new treatment approaches and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Pat.
Thank you very much, and hello from beautiful New Mexico, the land of enchantment. When one talks about liver cancer, one has to realize that there are two different cancers that can emerge within the liver. One is what we call hepatocellular carcinoma, the most common one, and that's the one that is most commonly associated with some of the risk factors that you all have heard of before. And another kind, which is a bile duct cancer that can also originate within the tissue of the liver from a cell that lines the bile ducts within the little lobules within the liver. The management of the two is different, and we will concentrate mostly on the management of hepatocellular carcinoma, and we just may touch upon cholangiocarcinoma, that is a liver cancer that originates from the bile ducts. The hepatocellular carcinoma is the most common primary liver cancer. The cholangiocarcinoma is the less common one. And in addition, there may be, and it's not uncommon, that patients have cancer in the liver that did not originate in the liver, but has come there from other sites, such as the metastasis from a cancer in the large bowel or in the stomach or in the pancreas, occasionally from a lung cancer. So we are dealing with cancer today that originates in the liver cells. For almost any cancer in the liver, the optimal treatment is to cut it out if possible. And if the cutting is not possible because of its size or location, if need be, try to give the patient a new liver, and that deals with the issue of transplantation. So these are the approaches that can completely or mostly to the highest degree eliminate the cancer surgically. In many cases, however, the possibilities of surgically cutting out the cancer are not possible because of additional circumstances, mostly the status or the condition of the liver that will remain behind, and if there is too little good liver tissue remaining after the surgery that can sustain a good life, one would not do such surgery. One would not do a liver transplantation if there is evidence that the cancer has spread outside the liver, or if there is evidence that the cancer in the liver is beyond a certain size or beyond a certain number or involves more than one area. The advantage of the liver transplantation is that it takes out the diseased organ. It may not eliminate the entire risk of future development of the disease or of liver cirrhosis, but it definitely buys a long period of time. The resection can be feasible. That means cutting out the cancer only, but leaving the rest of the liver in a place in the body, can be done when there is enough good liver that remains behind to sustain a good quality of life. So suppose if all those, neither cutting out the cancer nor replacing the liver with a new liver are options, then there are options that we offer our patients which are directly approaching the tumor by either, so to speak, cooking it. It's called a radio frequency ablation, where the radiologist will put a needle or needles into where the cancer can be seen, and then they will pass through that needle a radio frequency which will raise the temperature locally to a high, quite a significant amount of heat, which the heat itself will kill the cancer. You can identify then those cancers or the mass that you want to treat in that fashion with a radio frequency ablation, and then put in the gadget through a needle or a probe that will be placed in the middle of the liver mass that you want to destroy by that heat. And you pass the heat through that, and that the size of the probe that you put in will depend on the size of the tumor. This approach, the radio frequency ablation, is dependent on the size of the mass that you want to treat and its location within the liver. If it's close to blood vessels, there are limitations that limit that approach. The next approach that can be deployed or employed in the treatment of patients with hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer, primary liver cancer, would be what we call transarterial chemoembolization. And that is, there is an acronym which the first letters of those words that I just said, and the acronym is called TACE, T for trans, A for arterial, C for chemo, E for embolization. Through that, an interventional radiologist and a radiologist that his or her specialty is getting through the arteries directly into an organ, in that case the liver, identifying the blood vessel that feeds the lobe of the liver where the cancer is lodged, and through that artery and through the catheter that has been placed in that artery, inject particles of material that are combined with a chemotherapy that would lodge into that liver mass, and the chemotherapy will be locally lodged inside the mass of the tumor. If you think about it as a sphere or like a ball, you inject this material, you trap the blood inside that ball or mass of cancer by putting in some particles that will prevent the blood flow from leaving the blood vessel that fed that tumor. And that the material that blocks the flow is mixed with the chemotherapy and is slowly delivered over time into that mass, and quite frequently, quite effectively, kills this mass. You may have to repeat those procedure, and not infrequently. It needs to be done twice, three times, or four times, and you may repeat it at a later time if there is any evidence that the mass or the cancer has come back. If it has recurred or came back in another lobe of the liver, you may then treat another lobe of the liver with that approach. There are some new globules or drug-eluting beads So those beads can slowly release the drug where we want it to be released. And obviously, it's reached there by an injection that the doctor has injected into the tumor itself. But the same token that you can inject those beads mixed or that elude that the chemotherapy, you could also inject beads that emit radiation therapy. The radiation that would be used is yttrium-90, and those are there are two kinds of beads. Some are made out of glass. They come from a company in Canada. Some are made out of a resin that is some a plastic derivative, and those are injected and emit a very high local radiation locally to the tumor. And by virtue of them using a radioactive material that is called yttrium-90, that is it's a beta emitter. The rays that are emitted are a very short, penetrate a short distance of less than 0.8 of an inch, less than half an inch for sure. It's only about 0.5 centimeters or a fifth of an inch, so that it kills the cells locally but does not affect other organs. So that is another approach that is used. Now, suppose those options are not possible, and the cancer involves more than one lobe, multiple lobes, then we have the some new options today. Mostly there is a new drug that is the came on the horizon and approved probably not more than 2 years ago, a little over that, maybe 2.5 years ago. It's called sorafenib or Nexavar, which affects various genes specifically within the liver cancer. The drug was specifically approved for the treatment of liver cancer. It is approved also for the use in the treatment of primary kidney cancer. The interesting thing is that it had been associated with a slight prolongation of the patient's survival when treated with that agent called sorafenib or Nexavar. There are quite a few other drugs that will be coming up on the horizon that are products that interfere with the blood supply to the cancer, and thereby they manage to interfere with continued growth of the cancer. The most important aspect of the innovation of the new drug sorafenib or Nexavar is the fact that this is a basis upon which we can try and build more combinations of treatment to further improve the care of patients. That and in those I mean agents, either targeted agents that specifically work on specific genes or molecules that are involved in the development of the cancer, or we can combine it with chemotherapy. That specific sorafenib or Nexavar has been already used in combination with a chemotherapy that was previously used, named Adriamycin or Doxorubicin. We are using it in another interesting trial in a combination with a drug called Zeloda, or it's like 5-FU, an oral fluoropyrimidine. The bottom line is that there is a lot, we have a lot of options today. And the secret of good treatment of liver cancer is that one needs to be treated in a place where there is a group of physicians, scientists that are coming from multiple disciplines. It's a multidisciplinary approach, meaning the decision whether a specific patient is a candidate for the surgical intervention to cut part of the liver out, or for a liver transplantation, or for this arterial approach, or the radiofrequency ablation, or the combination of new agents. That has to be done by the patient and his partner, family, in collaboration with a group of physicians that come from the multiple disciplines, so as to be able to give the patient most of the benefit that has been derived by the recent changes and evolutions that we have observed in the treatment of liver cancer. And that is what makes us hopeful to see even further improvement. I'll stop at this point and I'll pass the microphone to, I assume, Dr. Messner, or is it going to Dr. Gish?
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Pat, for just a wonderful introduction and overview of liver cancer and its treatments. And it's now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Robert Gish. Dr. Gish is Chief of Clinical Hepatology. He is Professor of Clinical Medicine, Medical Director for CHAT, C-H-A-T, the Center for Hepatobiliary Disease and Abdominal Transplantation, UCSD Medical Center. And Dr. Gish is going to address the role of clinical trials, controlling symptoms and pain, and quality of life concerns. I now turn the program over to Dr. Gish.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. I appreciate very much being on this conference call. It's been very educational with the leadership of Carolyn and the other folks and colleagues on this line. I've learned a lot getting prepared for this. And I appreciate Dr. Pat's wonderful input and all the initial statements about liver cancer management. I'm going to be covering clinical trials, which would also be called clinical research. And this, of course, relates to three different areas. One area where we do research or clinical trials is with tools that you've already heard about today for treating liver cancer that we know work at a defined level in terms of prolonging life or possible cure for patients, but also how to fine-tune those procedures or those treatments. And that may be a combination of a ablative therapy where we might be heating the tumor with an oral pill like what we heard of sorafenib or Nexavar, or a combination of liver transplant and then a way of modifying treatment after transplant to prevent cancer from recurring, or if cancer comes back, to treat that cancer by either changing the way the immune system works or using agents that directly treat the cancer. So these are considered phase four trials or trials with approved therapies. And then, again, it's approved therapies in combination. We think of cancer sometimes like a virus, that it's not going to be just one therapy that works best, but maybe two or three therapies being used at the same time or one after the other, maybe in sequence. And it's these clinical trials, it's this research that helps us refine the use of our current tools. So clinical trials involves you talking to your practitioner or researcher at the center where you or your family member may be cared for, and going through the process of informed consent. That informed consent is very important. It's both verbal and written. Typically takes place between the patient and their support, their family, and the researcher, and walks through the risks and the benefits of the specific intervention, what we're using, the tool we're using to treat, maybe how long, what the combination means, what the side effects might be, how we would manage side effects, what the chance of a side effect might be. In clinical trials, we try our best to design those to help individual patients. But sometimes the clinical trials are meant to explore whether a therapy has a role at all in managing liver cancer. And this is where the clinical trials moves into what we would call a little bit more of the true research realm, where a medication might be in research before the human phase of the research trials, and then we're ready to give it to people with cancer. But we tell the patient, well, it worked in a research setting, but we haven't given this to patients yet. You may be one of the first patients that's given a new treatment, whether it's something that goes into the artery that feeds the liver cancer or through the skin to treat the tumor through the skin through a probe of some type, or a pill, or something that would be given intravenously in a tube or a fluid that would go into the vein. And it's this research that really holds a huge amount of promise for the future. Dr. Pat already talked about how these medicines, the one that we have currently, sorafenib, is taken as a pill, and it goes right in and targets a signal that goes from one part of the cell, the cancer cell, to another part, or maybe a signal that goes from a non-cancer cell in terms of getting it stimulated to turn into cancer. And these research medications are meant to interfere with that signaling. In the previous history of treating cancer, we use what were called chemotherapy or chemotoxic agents. And yes, we poison the tumor, but we're also sometimes having a lot of toxicity or side effects in the patients. We're trying to find out that there's trials that are going to have much less side effects and much more benefit for patients. And I think this is a very useful segue now to talk about adverse events. And I'm going to walk basically in parallel with what Dr. Pat said about different treatments and what some of the side effects might be. So surgery, if you cut out part of the liver, there might be a side effect of that surgery where part of the liver edge might have some blood or some bile, and that would be treated by the doctors in the hospital, the surgical team after that. But typically after a surgical resection, even though we're not doing a lot of those procedures these days with the surgical cutting out of the tumor, once people have gotten over the surgery in, 5, 10, 15 days, they typically are doing quite well unless the liver stop working or is not working as well. And then you would be seeing side effects of or complications of just the underlying cirrhosis. And as you know, 80 out of 100 patients with liver cancer have serious or very advanced liver disease in the background. And this is where I have a major role, or people in my specialty as a liver doctor have a role in partnering with the oncologist, partnering with the patient's family, is to manage the complications of cirrhosis, and that might be swelling of the feet or water that accumulates on the abdomen, mental confusion that's called encephalopathy, internal bleeding. We need to prevent that. We have different tools to do that. And, of course, keeping people's nutrition, keeping them strong. And you're going to hear just a few moments more about nutrition and managing cancer and sometimes the underlying liver disease. The therapeutic ablations that you heard about, where we heat up the tumor, or we go in through an artery and attack the tumor from the inside, those can result in either bleeding or infections, although these adverse events are pretty rare. They can happen, so we usually use antibiotics to prevent that. And, of course, we closely watch liver function and how the liver is doing in terms of processing fluids, moving fluid through the body, balancing blood products, coagulation, liver function. Sorafenib, very important issue. And that is, this is a targeted therapy that has side effects that include rash, include diarrhea, and include something called the low phosphorus that's in the blood. Phosphorus is important for energy. And we would turn to our nutrition colleagues and ask for ways to supplement phosphorus to keep that higher in the blood. Some patients can have nausea with sorafenib or have nausea with some of the other therapies where they feel sick to their stomach, and we have good medicines to counteract nausea that we can use. They're quite effective, not always perfect. And then pain. Pain management is an important part of this, although pain with liver cancer typically does not occur until very late in the course of the disease. It could be from a very large tumor replacing the liver, or where cancer may have spread to an area of bone or another part of the body, a lung. And pain management would be considered standard as we would with other types of cancer. But most importantly, acetaminophen, commonly called Tylenol. Tylenol is very, very safe in people who have liver disease. A person with basically any type of liver disease can take up to 2 grams of acetaminophen or Tylenol per day with impunity, with no risk to hurting their liver or hurting their body. And then, of course, medications like Vicodin or morphine or fentanyl or Demerol can also be used. Dilaudid, sometimes methadone, are used for pain management when the pain's quite severe. We've become much better at pain management as physicians and practitioners and providers through our co-management, typically with pain management services, now often called palliative care teams. And we bring in those palliative care teams early because they are experts at symptom management, and we like to work very closely with these teams, with our oncology partners, sometimes with our surgical colleagues, to improve quality of life. And really, quality of life is what I'm going to use as my closing here, and that is that we are looking for cures for our patients. We're looking to extend life as much as possible, and that's not just a numerical extension, but it's an extension of life with quality. And we as providers think about that every day as we're balancing the risks and benefits of different treatments that we have, either standard treatments or clinical trials or a combination of standard therapies as we're moving into research studies. And I'd like to, again, just bring back the point that we really do commonly have to manage the complications of liver failure. And as hepatologists, as liver experts, we're a cornerstone of the team, just like the oncologists, surgeons, radiologists, interventional radiologists, is to minimize side effects, improve quality of life, extend life with quality to manage liver cancer. And I think it's now time to segue to our nutrition component.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Gish, for just an excellent, very very comprehensive presentation, but also just great compassion in terms of presentation and addressing just the controlling of symptoms and pain and quality of life issues, and also helping people understand more about clinical trials. So thank you very much. And our next speaker is, as you had said, a nutritionist, our dietitian, Dexibin Amen. And she is a senior clinical dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Ammon is going to address nutritional concerns and eating hints. Ms. Ammon?
Thank you, Carolyn. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to cover nutritional concerns and eating hints for the liver cancer. Nutrition goals for liver cancer are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition in order to maintain scheduled cancer treatments, to manage symptoms and side effects that can occur from the cancer itself as well as the cancer treatment, as our doctors just covered in the previous presentation, and to maximize the quality of life. General nutrition recommendations for liver cancer are: eat small but frequent meals throughout the day. Try to eat every 2 to 3 hours, to equal to 6 to 8 smaller meals per day. This will provide your body with small bits of energy throughout the day. Try to plan meals and snacks the day before if possible. For example, if you know you will be away from home most of the day for treatment and or doctor's appointments, make sure to pack calorie and protein dense snacks to bring with you, like peanut butter and crackers or a protein bar, something like that. Drink plenty of fluids. A general rule of thumb is 8 to 10, 8 ounces of cups of fluid per day. Consume adequate amounts of protein like dried beans and peas, poultry, meat, and dairy products. Choose nutrient-dense foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and stay as active as you can. Unintentional weight loss is a common issue for people who have liver cancer. Weight loss is usually caused by an inadequate calorie intake, which is likely caused by various symptoms of the cancer and or the side effects of the treatment. Treating the cause will usually help to increase calorie intake and stop the weight loss. Some common symptoms and side effects are poor appetite and early satiety, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, ascites, and encephalopathy. If you are experiencing poor appetite and early satiety, which means getting full quickly, I would encourage to consume small but frequent meals throughout the day. Avoid overly sweet foods or liquids, as well as greasy, fried, or highly spiced foods. Maintain good oral care and use liquid meal supplements like smoothies or supplement drinks as a small meal. If you are experiencing nausea with or without vomiting, eliminate offending odors. Try room temperature or cooler foods because they tend to give off fewer odors. Drink liquids in the cup with a lid. Try dry crackers or toast. Try sour or tart flavors. Use anti-nausea medications as prescribed by your doctor to adequately control the nausea so that you can eat better. If you are experiencing diarrhea, limit or avoid the following: lactose, but yogurt and buttermilk are okay. Insoluble fiber like wheat bran and whole grain products. Foods sweetened with sugar alcohol and sugar-sweetened beverages. If you are experiencing diarrhea, increase the following: foods with live active culture like yogurt, soluble fiber like oats, high potassium and sodium foods or beverages to replace the lost electrolytes if you are vomiting, and extra fluids in general to replace the losses. If you are experiencing ascites, which is retaining fluid in the abdomen, then consume small frequent meals throughout the day and decrease the sodium in your diet to help decrease the fluid retention. If you are experiencing encephalopathy, which is impaired brain function due to the liver's inability to detoxify the body, this is usually treated with medication. Know that protein balance is important for maintaining lean body mass, so consume adequate amounts of protein daily. Spreading the amount of protein consumed evenly throughout the day will be more helpful. At last, I would like to talk briefly about the guidelines for supplementation. You want to avoid megadoses of vitamins and minerals. A daily standard over-the-counter multivitamin and mineral supplement, as well as calcium with vitamin D supplement, are okay. And finally, correct vitamin and mineral deficiencies under the care of doctor or the dietitian. Know that you can always meet with a dietitian for more personalized information as well, because many times individual care might be different based on how your doctor gives you the treatment. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of this teleconference. Now I will pass the line back to Caroline. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Dexa. Excellent presentation, really very comprehensive, and a lot of issues around food intake, and you really addressed many of the concerns that people on the phone may have. So thank you, and Well, we now do have time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board, and I want to invite all of you to ask a question of our speakers, and Mary will explain to you how to queue up and ask a question, and we're all here. We are. You have here a multidisciplinary team of experts here to ask questions of, so we invite you to ask your questions. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Ann S.
I have a question of Dr. Pat. Could you briefly please address the current treatment options for the less common form of liver cancer, cholangiocarcinoma? Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Dr. Pat.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. there are, again, very, it's, again, an issue of multidisciplinary approach. A cholangiocarcinoma, as I said before, depends, is a cancer that originates in the bile ducts. Where exactly it originates in the bile ducts will determine what kind of symptoms the patient comes in with. So if the patient appears to be yellow, jaundiced, and that would usually be noticed by the patient seeing that his or her urine is darkening almost to the color of tea or coke, or the stool is does not have its normal brownish color, but more a tan color. Or the patient may feel that he is itching, and his friends, relatives, spouses, etc., will notice that he becomes yellow. That will be an indication that the tumor, it's not always necessarily originating in the liver. It's more commonly originating in something like the pancreas, or it could be stones, but that would indicate that the patient has obstruction of the bile ducts. And the mainstay of management, number one approach, is unblocking the blockage. And that is done, as we said, by the multidisciplinary approach. So that is done by an endoscopist from the gastroenterology group that is specialized in dealing with passing a tube through the stomach, the duodenum, and finding the opening where the bile duct goes into the duodenum, and demonstrating where exactly the narrowing is, or the tumor has constricted that bile duct, and putting in a stent through that constriction to allow the drainage of the bile. That is the most important initial aspect of treatment. Subsequently, you can try and see which of the various treatments that we mentioned, some of them before, is appropriate. Is resection of the cancer possible? Or is resection and restoration of the contiguity of the bile duct? Okay, so once we manage the issue of the flow of the bile, then the cancer will be dealt with. And now the issue is, and we have to determine its extent, its location, and whether surgery is an option or surgery is not an option. And now we have some newer chemotherapeutic agents that are quite in fact, they are not very new, but there was a new trial that described the good results from a drug called gemcitabine and combining it with another drug that has been available for almost 40 years or 35 years, cisplatinum, at rather low doses. It's a well-tolerated treatment, and we are doing some trials combining it with agents such as the signal transduction inhibitors. One of them is called erlotinib, and we are using it in a trial, which is quite promising. So the determination that the multidisciplinary group has to determine, that includes the radiologist and interventional radiologist and the endoscopist, gastroenterologist, oncologist, they have to determine, is surgery possible? Do we need to drain, first of all? And when can we actually start treatment if surgery or a transarterial approach is not possible? When can we start treatment with a chemotherapy and a signaling inhibitor? These are called TKI. A TKI that is the inhibitor, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, that can inhibit the message going from one cell to the other, as Dr. Gish mentioned before. I would encourage people to participate in clinical trials, but definitely to be seen in by a group of specialists to decide how to deal with the cancer.
Thank you very much. Excellent response to that question. And our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Roberta C.
Hi, this is Sanam Shah from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. You talked a lot about treatments, but in a healthy individual, how do you, if there's no signs and symptoms, how do you pick up any tumors, or is there any gene lab tests? Are there any body scans? How would you pick up the diagnosis of cancer?
Good question. Thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. Gish to address that question.
Great question. And the question breaks into two parts, screening for liver cancer and surveillance for liver cancer. And that's determined by guidelines. We have U.S. guidelines, international guidelines on who should have tests for liver cancer. And basically, you have to have a risk factor for liver cancer. And most commonly, worldwide, it's hepatitis B. And in the United States, it's hepatitis C. So once you have either of those viruses, then you have a discussion with your practitioner, your provider, about when liver cancer testing should be started. Typically, anybody with signs of cirrhosis, even early cirrhosis, by imaging or biopsy or blood tests or physical exam, you would start liver cancer screening, which is the first test, and surveillance, which is all subsequent testing. And there's a blood test for liver cancer. It's not very good. It's called an alpha fetoprotein. It's been around for maybe 30 or 40 years. It's a test that more indicates future risk. It's not good to diagnose liver cancer today. To diagnose cancer now, at a given time, in a given patient, is done by imaging, typically either a CT scan or an MR scan, magnetic resonance scan, and those need to be done by what's called a four-phase technology. They take four different types of pictures over a short period of time, and in the great majority of patients, we diagnose cancer by imaging. We don't need a liver biopsy. Liver biopsies, cancer biopsies, are done in maybe 5 out of 100 people when the scans are indeterminate. So an MR, CT, in the right individual, at risk. A blood test may indicate a higher risk, but symptoms are not used to decide who needs testing for liver cancer in most people, because then it's usually an advanced cancer if there's actually symptoms, and you would look and say, oh, we should have started this or done this test a month ago or a few years ago. So take a risk history, laboratory tests, look for risks such as cirrhosis, think about a blood test, talk to your provider. There's even more questions that need to be asked to determine that final person that would go down advanced testing. Finally, ultrasound is the test that we use for screening and surveillance first, every 6 months in high-risk individuals. But ultrasound's not perfect. We move quickly to an MR or CT scan. If the ultrasound is equivocal or it hints at something being wrong, or this blood test might be elevated or increasing over time. So there are caveats, although ultrasound is the standard.
Thank you very much. Excellent. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lewis R.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. How's everyone? Thank you so much. I'm interested in the IV vitamin C treatment. I don't know much about it, but I've been reading a little bit about it, and it seems to have good results. I understand that it has to be someone that's licensed, a medical doctor, and he has to be a naturopathic. And I wanted to know, what's your feel about the IV vitamin C treatment, and how would I go about finding someone that's licensed, you know, to administer this?
Well, thank you. Thank you for your question. Dr. Gish, could you comment on that?
You know, intravenous vitamin therapy for liver cancer at this point I would describe as experimental, even though vitamin C has been around for a while. There's other vitamins that may have some anti-cancer effect. At this time, there's no evidence that intravenous vitamin C or other vitamins would directly have an anti-tumor or anti-cancer effect. So I would move that to a request for a clinical research trial and see if we can show what the role of vitamin C might be for cancer management.
I'm going to ask Dr. Pat also if you would comment just on the treatment of liver cancer in terms of the search for evidence-based treatment and how that applies in a question like this in terms of participating in a clinical trial or also just being aware of evidence-based care.
Most of the newer treatments are based on the use of genetic markers, signal markers that we have that have been identified over the last probably less than 10 years, with really the evolution, the explosion in the knowledge in the biology of cancer and in biology of cells, and the ability to identify a specific transmitter, a signal transduction within a cell, and the design of agents that are specifically designed to inhibit some of them. So there are, for instance, agents such as anti-angiogenic agents, that is, agents that inhibit the or normalize the blood flow to cancers, which we know that the pattern of the blood flow to cancer is not like the pattern of the blood vessels that supply normal tissue. And normalization or changes in those blood vessels can deprive tumors of their nutrients or oxygen, if you will, and thereby prevent their further growth. We know that the cancer or deposit of cancer may start with one or a few cells deposited in a place, let's say in the liver or in the lung or wherever, and subsequently, after the initial nidus of tumors started, that group of cells have to secrete materials that will promote nutrients coming to it. So these are factors that, or like attractants, they would attract blood vessels. There would be signals from other cells to give them signal to grow further. So what we do today is, in addition to the older chemotherapy agents that we have been using, we have been incorporating agents such as Avastin. We're looking at blockers or inhibitors of transmission from epidermal growth factor receptors. We are looking for, and there are trials already, with agents called mTOR inhibitors. So the clinical trials that we are doing are rationally designed and potential inhibition of some action that occurs in the cancer cells, and molecules have been developed of monoclonal antibodies against the receptor. And this is how the progress that we have seen, recent progress in cancer, has occurred. But in terms of vitamin C, I do not know that there is any specific mechanism in the cell that we know that it is involved. And if it ever comes to experiment with that or look at that, I by whole heart support what Dr. Gish said. We need clinical trials to see, first of all, to understand how it works. But even if we don't understand and it works, can we prove that it does better than start a treatment or not?
I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've just been extraordinary. It's been a remarkable call, and you've done a wonderful presentation on liver cancer, its update and treatment. Very informative and really outstanding. And I also want to thank all of our participants today who have been on the call, and some of you who actually asked such wonderful questions that really enhanced our call today, and, of course, all of you who have been listening. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. So I do want to remind you of all those different services that you can access from Cancer Care. We have a staff of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, and they're all free. We offer practical and financial assistance. We offer counseling services, both individual and also on the telephone in groups. We offer online support groups and telephone support groups. We also have, of course, many of these workshops that we offer, as well as a number of materials that we print, both printed fact sheets and booklets. Most importantly, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with liver cancer, in coping with cancer. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we're here to help you. And we are simply a telephone call away. And you can call us at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Please do utilize our services and take advantage of the help that our staff can provide. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.